You're listening to Precinct 444, a podcast network from the National Law Enforcement Museum. Today we're bringing you an episode from the Encore series, where we revisit past museum programs and conversations.
On this episode of Encore, we're headed back to June 24th, 2020, when we hosted a virtual panel discussion entitled The Definition of Insanity. The program was part of an exploration of the PBS documentary of the same name. The film takes a closer look at the Miami-Dade Criminal Mental Health Project, which is a prison diversion program for those suffering from serious mental illnesses, referred to throughout the program as SMI, or individuals with co-occurring SMI and substance use disorders, which will be referred to as SUDs. The webinar takes a deeper look at the Jail Diversion Project, as it's discussed in the film, and how public servants aim to support those suffering with mental illness through the difficulty of potential incarceration and on the path to recovery and support. This discussion is moderated by Nancy Lavine of the Justice Policy Center at the Urban Institute, with panelists Alejandro Aristizabal, the Felony Diversion Program Manager of the 11th Judicial Circuit Court of Florida, Sergeant John Blackerby of the City of Miami Police Department, Habsi Kaba, a Crisis Intervention Team Coordinator of Miami-Dade County, Judge Stephen Leifman, the Associate Administrative Judge of the 11th Judicial Circuit Court of Florida, and Jenny Conklin, Assistant State Attorney at the Miami-Dade State Attorney's Office. We have divided this program into two parts. In this first episode, you will be introduced to our panelists and learn more about their roles within the Miami-Dade Criminal Mental Health Project, how the project began, and what role local law enforcement plays in implementing this project. So now we present part one of The Definition of Insanity.
I'm Nancy Lavine. I'm with the Urban Institute in Washington, D.C. We're a nonprofit research organization where I head up the Justice Policy Center there. And as my introduction indicated, I've done a fair amount of work on policing. And I think we can all agree that policing is at a crossroads right now. And it was just such a pleasure and delight to be invited to facilitate this panel so that we can learn about an example, which I think we were talking in a pre-meeting about how this essentially humanizes the badge. There is an example here that you'll be hearing about that shows that officers can learn different strategies and different ways of interacting with members of the public to the benefit of all, to their personal safety and to the safety of the residents that they interact with. So, with that, I just want to share that you have an amazing panel of experts before you. If you saw the documentary, you'll know and recognize some of these faces. And I'm going to invite each of them to introduce themselves and share what their role is in the jail diversion program and or the crisis intervention team component of it. And so that you can get a flavor for what this program is, if you haven't seen the documentary, or to bring it to life a little bit more for you, even if you have. So with that, I'd like to start by inviting Judge Leifman.
Thank you. And thank you so much for participating today. And we appreciate the opportunity. My name is Steve Leifman. I am a judge in Miami-Dade County, Florida. I've been on the bench for about 23 years. About 20 years ago, I was getting ready to go on the bench, and I was approached by the assistant public defender and the assistant state attorney. And they asked me if I would speak to a couple whose son was in jail on a case I was about to hear. And it was a low-level misdemeanor case where the gentleman was still in jail. At that time, judges in Florida and throughout the United States had very little training, if any, regarding mental health issues. So this lovely couple came into my chambers. They started to tell me about their son. They told me he was brilliant. He had gone to Harvard. He had a late onset of schizophrenia, and they just didn't know what to do. And I was pretty new at the time, and I knew nothing about these issues, and I made the mistake of promising them that I would get their son help. Well, as I started to go back into the courtroom to handle his case, the mom stopped me and said, "You know, Judge, respectfully, he probably knows more about these issues than you do." And I was a little confused what she was trying to tell me, and she said, You see, my son is the former head of psychiatry at Jackson Memorial Hospital. And it turned out he was a Harvard-educated psychiatrist who had a late onset of schizophrenia and just disappeared until he ended up getting arrested. And the case really opened up a window to me and our system about everything we were doing wrong. And we were able to put together a group of folks. We had a summit and we laid out a plan that 20 years later has really turned into a model. And I'm thankful because of the amazing people that I work with that have really been able to turn this into an extraordinary experience. And it's done a lot more than we even anticipated. It has substantially reduced our arrests. It has substantially reduced our police shootings. It has substantially reduced our recidivism rates. And we're really proud of what we've been able to accomplish. And I'm looking forward to talking more about it this afternoon. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge. So I asked you to share your role, but you didn't use the title architect. I think I would call you the architect and implementer. So thank you for that. Let's turn it over to Jenny.
Good afternoon. My name is Jenny Conklin. I'm an assistant state attorney at the Miami-Dade State Attorney's Office. My boss, Catherine Fernandez-Rendell, was supposed to be here today, but she was unable to make it, and she sends her regrets. I am the division chief of the Treatment Courts Unit for Miami-Dade County Prosecutor's Office. I'm the person who oversees the attorneys that work in the felony mental health court, and I actually did it myself a couple of years ago working with Alejandro and his team. Our role in the program, our role as prosecutors, our goal is to protect the community. And sometimes there's really, really bad criminals out there and they need to go to prison. But there's sometimes people out there who get involved in the criminal justice system because of mental illness, and they are not truly dangerous individuals. And we need to respond appropriately. Not everybody needs to be locked up. And that's where the Felony Mental Health Diversion Program comes in. For individuals with serious mental illness, this is a great resource for our office to make sure that people get the treatment that they need in order to take control of their lives and in order to become upstanding, good law-abiding members of the community. Sometimes they just need a little bit of guidance. For individuals with serious mental illness, a lot of times they need extra assistance and can't make it through prosecution on their own, or not prosecution, but can't make it through probation on their own. And that's where the benefit of the Felony Mental Health Program comes in. Our role in the program, apart from making referrals, when we find out from victims or witnesses or police officers that an individual suffers from a mental illness, we'll refer them to the program. And then once we refer them to the program will determine whether they meet the clinical eligibility. And then that's where we get involved in approving them to participate in the program. We accept individuals into the program, generally speaking, with third degree or nonviolent second degree felonies, individuals who have felonies on the lower end of the scale. And we also look at the charges that an individual is facing, the wishes of the victim, and that sort of thing. Our goal is to make sure that we're picking people or that we're approving people who would be good for the program, who would be a good fit program, and who we believe can benefit from the program, because there is such a demand for the program. There's so many people that want to get in, and we need to make sure that those that really need it and would benefit the most from it could participate in it. Again, it's about protecting the community. And when we can protect the community best, sometimes it's by getting people treatment and making sure that they can become members of the community and succeed.
Thank you, Jenny. Alejandro.
Hello, good afternoon, Nancy, and good afternoon, everyone. Thanks. I'm very happy to be part of the panel. My name is Alejandro Aristizabal. I'm the team leader of our Felony Mental Health Diversion Program. I lead a small team of mental health and criminal justice professionals from a number of agencies. And annually, we coordinate about 200 persons leaving institutional settings like prisons, jails, hospitals, and helping them reintegrate appropriately into the community. Now, the 200 persons are all living with serious mental illnesses and co-occurring substance use disorders. It's fair to say I'm a middle manager, often tasked with designing and implementing some of the ideas that our visionaries like Judge Lifman have. I think an integral part of our program has to do with the cross-system collaboration that we experience. We've really been able to generate cooperation across the board and been able to intervene at all the critical points that a person goes to as they flow in and out of the criminal justice system. So I'm really happy and proud that I have to lead a team from different agencies. We have probation on our team. We have a probation officer specially assigned to our team for us to work with defendants in the community. We have persons inside the jail in the health setting. Corrections Health has assigned us someone to help us on the team. We also have a corrections counselor. We have staff from the administrative office of the courts, which is my employer. And so it's really cutting edge what we've been able to do here. I know other communities do this well and do have the need. And we've really been able to combine them all together to get our participants and our community safer and improve the quality of life of the people that participate in our program. And that's what my role really entails.
Thank you for that. That sounds like a role where you wear many hats, actually.
Well, we're all on one mission, though, and that's the great part, that we're all going towards community safety and ensuring access to care. Sometimes I even say I lead the three judges and the two attorneys on our mental health team, but anyone that thinks they could lead five attorneys towards one goal is way out of line.
Like herding cats, I imagine. Sergeant Blackerby.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Sergeant John Blackerby of the City of Miami Police Department. I am currently in my 23rd year here in the City of Miami, and I am incredibly grateful to have seen the cultural shift that has occurred within my police department as a result of our involvement with the CIT program. The Judge Leifman came in as a judge at roughly the same time I became an officer, and that I was able to see this is honestly an incredible coincidence, but an amazing testament to what it is that he has done. I now work in a safer city. I'm safer, and our citizens are safer, I believe, as a direct result of this program. My responsibilities for the CIT program are those of a liaison between the officers and the program and all of its members. So, in essence, as with anything that involves human beings, we have to communicate. We have to send our problems up and down the chain as they occur. So, when an officer comes to me with a particular problem as it relates to the CIT program, they need it fixed. So that's where they'll contact me, and then I will be able to provide them with the contacts further up the chain as they're needed. Now that works both ways. When there are issues in the program that have now trickled down to my officers, well, that also needs to be addressed, because as with anything, the mistakes do roll both ways. So when it comes to changes in legislation, I make sure that my people are notified. When it comes to an issue with a particular receiving facility, well, my officers will address it, and then we, through the process, will address it. If we have an individual who is regularly found to be in crisis and they are a danger to the community, well, we'll send this information up the chain, and I will be a liaison so that I can direct them as the appropriate people to speak to.
Thank you for that. And last but absolutely not least, Hanfi.
Good afternoon, Nancy. Hello, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here today. I am a mental health professional. I've been in the field for 25 years. I was afforded the opportunity to work with Judge Steve Leifman and our team 17 years ago. I serve as the CIT coordinator for Miami-Dade County and our police mental health collaboration with the 11th Judicial Circuit Criminal Mental Health Project. I am also honored to serve on the board of directors for CIT International. We have over 3,000 CIT programs in the US and beyond, and I'm sure that some of our listeners today are a part of the CIT community in their own areas. CIT is all about mental health solution to a mental health crisis. It's about systems transformation. It serves as a platform, a community platform that brings all of its partners, key stakeholders, advocates, the community together. My role is to keep my finger on the pulse of our community and ensure that we identify any of those gaps and barriers in our community. We troubleshoot, streamline, bringing the right people, the right entities together so we can sit at the table and find a solution. It seems that forever, we've been working in silos, in our own silos, trying to do the same thing for the same people in our own community. Well, CIT breaks those barriers and brings everyone together so we can together meet the needs of people with mental illnesses in our community. There are many core elements, several core elements to CIT, and many know it as the gold standard of training for police officers. But it is also much more than just training. It's also about, as I mentioned, those partnerships, research, developing policies and procedures. Here in Miami-Dade County, we have 36 police agencies. And thankfully, we have every police agency in Miami-Dade County on board with CIT, along with all of our mental health community, our government agencies as well. And CIT, we offer a 40-hour specialized training for police officers that assists them to better understand mental illness, how to communicate, how to de-escalate, how to access our own community resources and navigate through the system, and to divert to treatment as necessary. Unfortunately, on all levels, government, mental health community, society, we have failed law enforcement. We have in the past not provided them with the tools and the resources. And now I can very proudly say that we are in Miami-Dade County, throughout all these years of collaboration and training and education and partnerships, police are very good at assessing, at de-escalating, at diverting to treatment. And we need to continue to pull together so we can have a vibrant system of care that everyone can access, and we can stop this vicious cycle.
Thank you so much. So one of my favorite things about being a facilitator is that I'm a very inquisitive person, and it's such a delight that I get to ask questions that I want to ask of the distinguished panelists. But I do want to remind you that after a few minutes, say 15 or so, we'll be taking questions from the audience. So please be patient. And also, if you hear answers while we're talking, maybe craft a new one. So let's start with, I think, one of the biggest philosophical components of the success story, and that is the notion of decriminalizing mental illness. And I'm wondering if Jenny and Judge Leifman, if one or both of you can share, you know, how you got people to think differently about people with mental illness who are so often just grouped in as people who commit offenses, they get jailed and incarcerated disproportionately, they are often homeless. And so I'm just wondering, you know, what were the strategies, what was the process to bring people in the court and the prosecutor's office along in this notion of decriminalizing mental illness?
When people, you know, by the time the cases come to us, there's already been something that happened in the community, and somehow there's been a crime that's been committed. And if you just look at it just on the criminal basis, you know, just there's been a crime that's committed. Does it meet the requirements? Yes. And do there need to be consequences for this crime? Yes, there need to be consequences. But if we just put people in jail, or we just put people in prison, or just do something like that, like the law prescribes, you know, the criminal punishment codes and that sort of thing, we're just going to get people coming back to us the same way that they went in, if not worse. And you know, when I speak to victims and witnesses and talk to them about trying to get them to approve treatment as an option for individuals, I'll tell them if we put them in custody, they're going to come back out just the same way or worse. Let's give them the opportunity to get treatment, get help, and let's see if we can affect some change so that this won't happen again. And if you explain it to people in that terms, and when you talk to people about it in that terms, it makes sense. A lot of our individuals that we deal with don't have significant criminal records, and they're not individuals that are commit violent crimes. Most of the times our witnesses and our victims are telling us, this person needs help. Can you make sure that they get help? So I think the community is becoming more and more aware of mental illness and the effect of mental illness on people's behavior. And the great thing about the program is I've worked in the program, and it's a great program. The program works. The people that work in the program do an amazing job, and I trust them. And I can convey that to people in the community that, you know, when I'm talking to my victims or my witnesses, it's a great program. Mm-hmm. It will decrease recidivism. Let's do something different. Let's give this person a chance, and let's see if we can fix this so that it doesn't happen again. And give them the opportunity to change.
Yes, Judge, please.
And I really appreciate the question, because people, there's so much misinformation about these issues, and so your question is so poignant. We started really slow, and we started with a summit, and it wasn't really telling anybody what they should do. We had to educate everybody about these issues first, and we literally spent 2 days in a meeting with the state attorney and a facilitator and all the other stakeholders. And we first mapped out the intersection between our community mental health system and our criminal justice system. And we saw these massive gaps. And we saw that the same people were recycling again and again and again. And what we decided to do, because this hadn't been done anywhere before, is we would start slow. So our initial diversion program was just nonviolent misdemeanor cases. And within a 2-year span, the recidivism rate in the misdemeanor division dropped from over 70% to 20%. And at that point, the state attorney realized, hey, this is how we really improve public safety, because these folks are ill. And, you know, look, if someone has Alzheimer's or dementia and they do something strange or bizarre, we don't throw them in jail. I don't know why we're throwing people with schizophrenia or bipolar disorder in jail if they're not dangerous. And so we started to have that understanding and that discussion. And the other point I would make is we really have two choices. Statistically, I think 98, 99% of people with mental illnesses who get arrested are released at some point. They're not committing such heinous offenses that they go to prison for long periods of time. So we have two choices. We could release people with treatment, or we can release people without treatment. And we know what happens if we release them without treatment. And so the data now has caught up to us, and we also have a lot of data that shows us for people that are not high risk, 1 or 2 days in jail increases recidivism rates by almost 40%. And so we're not accomplishing anything except spending a lot of taxpayer money, making people sicker, and making crime worse by the way we were doing it. And so this has changed that whole dynamic.
Yeah. And it occurs to me too that, you know, just in the last decade alone, general public awareness of mental illness has changed, and it's been destigmatized. And, you know, I'd venture to say that like everyone on this panel is close to someone or has a family member, an extended family member who has experienced some form of mental illness, maybe even themselves, right? So just like having that destigmatization, I think must have helped along the way.
Yeah, it's creating a cultural shift. And
yeah.
Now, even we can look at our data from police arrest, which we'll get into later, but you're now the cool police officer if you get pushed or hit by somebody with a mental illness and you don't make the arrest. And we can see it in the data. And so there's
That's
this
like culture. Flipping the narrative. I love it.
And it's really exciting.
I'm going to pitch my next question to Alejandro, because in watching the documentary, I made note of the fact that compliance with meds is often an issue or a challenge. Hansi, you'll probably know about this too. You might want to weigh in. As well as just like the likelihood of relapse happens. And I'm wondering if you can just share your perspective on how you handle those issues.
Well, usually we're handling all our cases on an individualized basis. So before we enroll you in our project, we have a pretty good understanding because we've used empirically validated assessment tools, and they give us an understanding of your risk level of reoffend, your likelihood of reoffending, as well as the severity of your substance use disorder. And a lot of the decisions we are making are based on that and making sure that you're not punishing someone in the program because they relapsed on drugs. We understand that that is part of recovery, but you do hold them accountable for things that can easily be done, such as going to an appointment. And this is something that we learn in the field called proximal and distal goals, and we take those into consideration. The goal right now is getting you to see the doctor. The long-term goal will be for you to stay clean and sober off of drugs and stay out of the hospital. But our team really works on an individualized basis, and we're very fortunate that we implemented these assessments and tools years ago, and it really helps the whole team, including the judges and the attorneys. On a regular basis, we're case conferencing and they have access and we're all looking at the same data. It's really data driven where we understand our clients and what their needs are because we've been able to implement these processes.
Alejandra, can you mention the role of the peers and how they play a role in that as well?
The peers are huge, and that's something that I had in my notes to discuss a little later is a piece of advice to all projects out there. You want to have peer input at all stages of your program. You want to have the peers help in the design of your program. You want to help peers review your program. And that's what we have been able to do for years. I've been with the project 16 years. Yes.
Can you define peers? Who are peers?
Thank you. Yes. We define peers as persons with a unique lived experience with the mental health system, with the substance abuse system, and or the criminal justice system. So we actually employ, and you see Justin is our super peer. You also see Walter, Julie, a couple of our peers come out in the film, Leah, and what they have an experience and a unique relationship with the clients that none of us could really have. They have been in recovery, they are engaged, and they are now helping us engage others and show them that recovery is possible. And not only that, they keep the staff in check as well. They really are our eyes and ears on the ground, and they're the pulse of how our whole caseload is doing.
Yeah, in the research literature, we often call them credible messengers, people that the clients will understand and relate to and listen to. Hazi, did you have anything to add?
Yes, and in one word, education. Because it's not just about medication, it's treatment. It's not just off your meds, it's about treatment. And so one of the very common barriers to the revolving door, of course, is not just the lack of funding, but it's the lack of insight of individuals. And so platforms like the National Alliance on Mental Illness is a resource that our officers as well use and learn about so they can, okay, this person doesn't recognize that there's a mental illness, that they're in crisis. Well, okay, they're meeting our criteria for involuntary hold, but I'm also going to provide them with the resources for education in the future, or else they're back out and, you know, the revolving door continues.
Nancy, can I just real quick add on that? Because I think medication compliance is so important. I think most people think if people just take their medication, they're going to be fine and they're going to recover. We also have to address some of the social determinants that come with that. If they're still homeless, if they still have a substance use issue, the medication's not going to mean a whole lot to them. And what we found is for so many of the people that first come into our program, they have clinical depression on top of their serious mental illness. It's not that they don't want to take their medication. They don't care if they're breathing that day. And one of the things that the peers help us do is develop relationships with people that helps incentivize them to want to start to get better. It's elegant and simple, but it's more complicated than most people realize.
If I could build on what everybody said, at least for our office, you know, we have participants who'll, you know, come into felony mental health court and they'll start experiencing symptoms and they'll do something unusual or they'll use a substance to try and deal with things to affect their symptoms or different things like that. And what we know about mental illness is that it's cyclical. And even if you're on medications, things can happen. And sometimes symptoms will come back a little bit more. Sometimes they'll go away. And a lot of the individuals that we work with and that we really target in this, the felony mental health program, at least, is individuals who are newer to experiencing these mental health symptoms and experiencing life with a mental illness. And part of relapse is it's a tool, I guess, or what we do when we deal with relapse is try and get them to develop insight into the relapse, what triggered a relapse if they used substances, and to try and get them to develop insight into it. If they're starting to experience symptoms again, try and help them to become aware of what's causing them to experience their symptoms again. Because just the fact that they might have, you know, fallen back a little bit in their path doesn't mean that they're not on the right path. Sometimes they just need assistance. And that's the wonderful part of this program, is that the court's there every day to make, you know, or on a monthly basis to make sure that people are engaged and developing this understanding, and the peers are there and everybody's involved to help these individuals learn to understand these triggers and their symptoms and come to terms with dealing with them on a long-term basis.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. I'm going to switch gears a little bit and invite Sergeant Blackerby to share more about what he's experienced and observed around getting officers bought into this, because as we all know, they're on the front lines and they're interacting with folks in the community who are in crisis.
Well, I'll tell you that Hobsy certainly has more experience with the pushback because of her experience as an educator of law enforcement. What I will tell you about my own experience is that the overall cultural shift that has occurred in my agency since I've been here has been really profound. And as Judge Lightman has mentioned previously, there's what officers used to look at as, well, this situation is one where I have to use force. They're now given accolades for not using force. And because we've adopted this program so fully and it's so integrated into our police department, what I have noticed personally is that, as I have put before, individuals who are accustomed to being policed, they come in and out of the program out of law enforcement hands frequently. When they come into the city of Miami and they are addressed by law enforcement officers here, while being policed, they often come back with a very positive response. Whereas, and they will straight out say, I dealt with X law enforcement agency and X law enforcement agency didn't treat me like a person. You still did your job, officer, but you treated me like a person. And that is something that I can 100% guarantee is something that came as a result of this program.
Join us for part two of this conversation, where we will continue exploring this project and really look at what the data shows, as well as some of the key challenges that face the Miami-Dade community and law enforcement when they're responding to mental health crisis calls. As always, thank you to Christopher Mitchell, our manager of digital content and strategy, for producing today's episode. And many thanks to all of you for listening to this episode of Encore, a Precinct 444 podcast from the National Law Enforcement Museum. We hope that you learned something from this episode of Encore and will join us again for part two of The Definition of Insanity.
Please subscribe to Precinct 444 on your favorite podcasting platform to stay connected and to receive our latest content as soon as it drops. We would love to hear from you. Send in your questions, comments, and feedback to precinct444@nleomf.org. You can help us make our content even better. The National Law Enforcement Museum is located at 444 East Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., and is dedicated to telling the story of American law enforcement. We expand and enrich the relationship between law enforcement and the community through educational journeys, immersive exhibitions, and insightful programs. Find us online at lawenforcementmuseum.org and stay tuned for more podcast content from Precinct 444. Until next time, stay safe. We'll see you at the precinct. Thank you.